Hey, if you're starting to think beyond your student loans, check out our other show, Financially Free Era. It's about what comes next, investing, building wealth, and designing a life you actually want. Just search for Financially Free Era wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Student Loan Planner Podcast. Today, we're going to take a bunch of listener questions. Just as a reminder, if you want to ask your own question, you can go to studentloanplanner.com/voicemail. There's all kinds of different questions about the future of student loans, the current state of the save mess, certain repayment plans getting cut off, how do you calculate certain things, what are big things with the new student loan regs that people need to be worried about. So there's a lot of really good questions today, so I think you're going to really enjoy this episode.
Hi, Travis. Thank you so much for all that you and your team do for all of us to understand and navigate the student loan landscape. I'm asking you to speak to the professional program grad students that are in the cohort that are about to take out their last loan, be dispersed after July 1st, and how that so drastically affects their repayment options. So much focus is on future borrowing and the changes around that. And I just don't see that this cohort and all, these professional grad schools really understands that one last loan is really going to change everything for them, for their options. So if you could just speak directly to that, I think it would be extremely helpful and easy to share. Thanks.
What a great question. I think that it would be illustrative to give an example of why this is such a big deal. So if you take out one loan or have any loans dispersed after July, your only option is the repayment assistance plan that's income driven. That is not even an option if you take out a Parent PLUS loan after July 2026. If you take out one Parent PLUS loan after July 2026, or you consolidated a loan that has any formerly Parent PLUS loans in it after July 2026, you don't have access to the wrap plan. You have access to nothing except for basically like fixed repayment plans. So let's say that you're borrowing for your own program to finish your own program. If you're trying to finish your own program and it's only a loan that's coming out that's direct, that's not a Parent PLUS loan, then you would only have access to the wrap plan. Now, here's how this could impact someone. Let's say that you have $200,000 of loans. Let's say that you make $120,000, your spouse makes $120,000. So we could maybe call this like two pharmacists married to each other, maybe something like that. If you have $200,000 of loans and $120,000 incomes, your household income is $240,000. But if you file your taxes separately, somebody could go for the new IBR plan and pay about $500 a month. And over a 20-year period, your total payments would be about $189,000. Over 20 years, that's less than your loans. And so if you factor in interest cost and the time value of money and things like that, this person's an excellent forgiveness case. But if you take out one single loan after July 2026, suddenly you're only able to use the RAP plan, the repayment assistance plan. That's a 30-year plan for forgiveness in the private sector. Running some math through, if you filed taxes separately, in that case, your payments would be enough to pay off the full loan. So you would have to pay, basically, your total payments would sum up to about $410,000 on a $200,000 loan, and you would pay it off over the course of about 25 years. Your payments would sort of look like a graduated type repayment schedule where it goes up over time as your income goes up over time. And because you're barely covering the interest, but just not a lot of it, but you're barely covering a little bit of principal more than the interest, you're just paying a ton of interest over a very long period of time. So contrast that to a private refinancing of 10 years at 5% fixed. You'd pay $254,000 over 10 years if you did a private refinancing in that case. So what's happening is that one single loan is turning somebody from a clear forgiveness case into a clear, you got to pay your loans off no matter what case. And the whole thing hinged on one loan that dispersed in the fall of 2026. So this is really not, people are not paying enough attention to this at all, in my opinion. You know, going from 10% of your income with, by the way, a very generous poverty line deduction to a 10% of your income for 30 years with very little in the way of a deduction, the payment difference is enormous, and it's going to push a lot of people into the you have no choice but to pay off your loans camp. So what a great question. Let's take another.
Hello. Thank you so much to you and your team for all that you have done. The information has been incredibly helpful. Our situation is that we are trying to change our plan from the safe forbearance to IBR. We are also on PSLF with 23 payment counts. When we try to do that online, the process brings us to the only two options that we are eligible for, it notes, is the standard repayment plan or the income contingent repayment plan. And it indicates that in order to be eligible for income-based repayment, we would need to consolidate our loans, which should not be the case. So I'm not really sure what the next step is. We are going to contact MUHELA, assuming we may have to do a paper application, but I know that this is all just a mess. So in the meantime, I was hoping you could provide some insight into the next best steps to ensure that we can get on the correct payment plan that we're eligible for without losing any of our PSLF counts. Thank you so much.
If somebody is getting only the ICR plan, they're probably somebody that used to have Parent Plus loans at one point in the process. So it is true that if you've ever had Parent Plus loans ever, even if you successfully got access to the pay or the save plans in the past through double consolidation, you do have to make one payment on the ICR plan before they'll allow you to switch to IBR. You do also have to have only direct loans. You can't have any Parent Plus loans, of course. So that's a little bit of a weird thing that's going on. The primary thing that matters, though, is, you know, the all of your loans are final and dispersed, you know, before that June 30th all-important deadline. So that's the thing that really matters the most. Let's take another question.
Hey, Justin. Thank you for everything you do. I've benefited a ton from all your efforts to teach us about student loans. I have two questions that I've had a hard time getting very clear and detailed answers on. For context, I'm currently on the Save Forbearance. I'm going for IDR forgiveness and ultimately plan to go for 25-year forgiveness under old IBR. The first piece of information I'm looking for is a detailed explanation of how one's payment is calculated when submitting pay stubs as proof of income when recertifying my income. So partway through 2025, I cut back my hours significantly. So my current income is a lot lower than my 2025 income. Specifically, my 2025 tax return had a AGI of 140K with a gross of about 170K. But my current income, my current gross income is 108K. So I still max out my 401K and contribute to my HSA, but I'm guessing if I submit pay stubs at this point, they're still going to use my gross income and not my AGI. Can you clarify exactly how pay stubs are handled to calculate a new payment? And is there any way to have them lower my income by taking into account my above-the-line deductions, such as my 401k and HSA contributions? Lastly, how many pay stubs do I need to submit? The second piece of information I've been looking for is exactly what events trigger capitalization of student loans. I told you I'm going for IDR forgiveness. I'm currently eligible for old IBR and pay. I was considering going into pay now from the Save Forbearance and taking advantage of 2 years of slightly lower payments. And then in the summer of 2028, switching from pay to old IBR and finishing out forgiveness on old IBR. Do both of those events trigger interest capitalization? Does one and not the other trigger interest capitalization? I've read that going from Save Forbearance to pay would not, but that going from pay to old IBR would. And I was hoping you could clarify which events do and do not. Thank you.
Well, Justin is our chief of staff for SLP, and I'm Travis. So, you know, I'm just kidding. I don't care that much. This is a good question. The interesting thing going on with this is the alternative documentation of income. You know, if your income is lower currently than it was on your last tax return, yes, you can show, you know, proof of income that shows that it's lower, right? Like pay stubs. I think that the problem is you can't have your cake and eat it too. Like if you're not going to use tax returns, you can't get deductions for things like HSAs and 401ks and stuff like that. So it's either or, right? You either just use the tax returns, which does take into account all those things, or you do pay stubs, which shows the lower income, but you're not going to get credit for things like 401k and HSA deductions. Interest capitalization, that's kind of interesting. When people are really worried about interest capitalization, it very often comes up in a consult where somebody's worried about it. I would not be worried about it. The reason I would not be worried about it is because if you are doing the wrap plan, if there's any big interest capitalization problems, if you do qualify for interest subsidies, the interest subsidies are going to take care of it. When you do pay off your loans, you're paying down accrued interest first, generally before principal. So you're going to be paying that off anyway. It's not like you're going to suddenly not owe it or something. And when you do a refinance or, you know, aggressively pay down your loans, like you're dealing with sort of similar math to like if the interest had already capitalized anyway, or, you know, certainly when you refinance, you do capitalize interest. The thing is people rarely run the math about what does the interest capitalization event actually mean and what does it mean when. So what I mean by that is it might mean one thing today. It might mean a totally different thing if you're making huge prepayments on your loans in 3 months from now. So what I would say is, having run the math in a lot of these situations, honest to goodness, people should not be that worked up or worried about interest capitalization. You're either going to be able to handle it with interest subsidies from the wrap plan if it does capitalize, or it's probably not a huge thing to worry about in any way in the first place, because you're probably going to have to be paying off the interest, and eventually you're going to be dealing with the same math of a capitalized loan anyway. So that would be my recommendation. The TLDR in that is just don't worry about interest capitalization. It's not worth losing any years of your life over, or even minutes of your life over. Let's take another question.
Hey, Travis, this is Peter from Philadelphia. I have a question about using the foreign earned income exclusion to get $0 payments on income-driven repayment plans. I'm a dual citizen planning to move to Europe permanently later this year. You've mentioned that using the foreign earned income exclusion can reduce adjusted gross income to zero, leading to $0 IDR payments. Have you seen any recent changes or risks that could affect this strategy? And do you think this is still a reliable long-term strategy?
The only risk is if I keep talking about it and somebody hears about this that doesn't like that. I mean, I'm joking, but kind of not. Foreign income exclusion is essentially a legal thing that says, you know, if you're paying taxes abroad and you're making money abroad, well, they're assuming that you're being taxed abroad, and in most every country you are, right? So if you're in the UK or France or something, and you're working there, or Australia, and you're paying taxes, essentially what the US government is basically saying is, you know, look, we know that somebody that's making $100,000 a year that lives in Germany probably doesn't have $5,000 to go hire an expat CPA that can coordinate their tax filing requirements in the United States and in Germany. So what the Congress has nicely done is basically they have this foreign earned income exclusion that says, hey, if your income, or, you know, the first 120K, I think it's maybe higher with inflation adjustments, but, you know, first 120 to 130K, you don't even have to report it, because we're just going to assume you're taxed abroad on it. Maybe you file a tax return saying $0 AGI because your first 130 is excluded from the AGI in the US that they calculate the tax on. And then over and above that, you get into some complex like tax treaty laws where it's like, okay, does the US have a tax treaty with the country you're in? If they do, generally they credit you with foreign taxes paid against the tax you would have to pay the United States, right? So, you know, generally speaking, like this foreign income exclusion is sort of like a loophole, because nobody thought about this requirement or this tax treatment in the context of student loans. Partly the reason for that is because U.S. citizens tend to not move abroad and live abroad permanently in numbers that are all that significant. Contrast that to a country like New Zealand, where that's extremely common. In fact, there's this bit, if you want to go down a really weird rabbit hole, there's this huge problem in New Zealand and Australia where people are essentially like, people will leave New Zealand, go to Australia and kind of dodge their New Zealand student loan requirements, and then vice versa. Like Aussies will like leave Australia and go live in New Zealand and dodge their Australian student loan requirements. And so there's a lot more draconian penalties for people that try to dodge student loans in Australia and New Zealand, I think, because of the higher percentage of people that become expats and live in other countries to try to, you know, I mean, not to try to dodge things necessarily, but end up dodging things, right? So the US doesn't really have that level of oversight, that level of, you know, care, I guess you could say, in making sure that people don't live abroad and have to pay nothing. So while that world exists, take advantage of it legally. Like, file your tax return in the United States every year, get that low AGI, give them, you know, permission to access your US tax return, and let them see that U.S. tax return shows a very low income. And, you know, any income-driven repayment plan is viable with this. If this does at some point get looked at, which it could, you just have to think through what are the implications, right? Like, are you willing to trash your financial situation in the United States? Maybe you are if you're not planning to move back there, right? That's not something you have to worry about, though, until you actually have to worry about it. So I would just say, Enjoy the FEIE, file the U.S. tax return. Hopefully your income is low enough where you don't have to worry about it. And yeah, we have, I don't know why Australia comes to mind, but there are, you know, there's a large number of SLP consult clients in Australia that are veterinarians that I think attended to some abroad veterinary program and like met Australian people and married them. And then they all live in Australia and they've been paying low to no student loan payments for years. And it's been legal because we've truthfully submitted U.S. tax returns, and the truthful U.S. tax return shows their income is zero, right? So we've been suggesting this strategy for years to people that it applies for and have not ever had any problems so far, but never say never, which is why just, you know, be thinking about all the implications of, well, you know, what are my ties to the U.S.? Do I have a lot of financial assets in the U.S.? That kind of thing. Interesting question. Let's take another.
Travis, I want to thank you and your team for all you do for us individuals who have six figures of student loan debt or are trying to navigate the student loan federal system or private system. With that said, as a mental health professional, you have talked in the past about the effects of mental health and how to alleviate some of the mental health aspects related to student loans. With all the changes, would you please take some time to speak to the mental health aspects?
I like this question a lot. I remember doing this back in the waning days of the Obama administration and then the first Trump administration. You know, what I noticed was really bad mental health surrounding student loan debt during that period, like the 2015 to 2020 COVID era, like before COVID. That window, student debt was taking a huge mental toll on people. It was really messing up people's quality of life, happiness levels. People had a lot of huge percentages were reporting anxiety, depression, stress, even suicidal ideation over student loans. So one of the pieces that we wrote once that went viral was something like one in 16 student loan borrowers in our survey had contemplated suicide due to their student loan debt, which is just unacceptably high. You know, so we know that debt can create all kinds of mental anguish among people. So I think about what happened differently. What changed is I noticed a massive change in people's self-reported mental health during the era of the student loan pause. So that lasted for 3 years, basically. And then the SABE plan came out and it was uber generous, right? And they weren't really requiring people to recertify their income-driven repayment either. So people were keeping ultra-low pre-COVID payments in a lot of cases. So I really noticed a huge drop-off in the number of people reporting mental anguish from their student loans during that Biden administration, let's cancel student loan debt level of activism that was existing. And a lot of people kind of forgot about their student loans. And when you forget about something that causes you stress, that lowers your stress levels, it lowers your levels of mental health problems from that issue because you're not even thinking about it, right? And what has happened in the Trump era so far, the second Trump era so far, is that the IDR recertification dates have continued to be pushed out. The SAVE plan has been under legal embargo or pause, but they've allowed the SAVE plan forbearance to continue on. So anybody who was feeling stress from their student loans could sign up for the SAVE plan, and then they got the SAVE plan forbearance, and so then they were having to think about it. And so the continuation of, I don't have to think about this for my student loans, sort of just continued on. And so what I am a little fearful of for folks is that era is going to be ending very soon. As of July, I think people are going to have 90 days in July to switch to something different, which means July, August, September. So basically in October, people are going to have to start making payments on the standard plan if they don't sign up for WRAP. And the WRAP plan payment is nowhere near as generous as SAVE. WRAP plan is much higher. Also, everybody's going to have to recertify probably with new tax returns at some point in the next few months or year. And so those new tax returns are going to reflect much, much higher incomes for most people, right, than people were earning before. So people's payments are going to skyrocket. The payment plans are going to be way less generous. Parent Plus folks who didn't consolidate in time are going to be completely out of luck and have no affordable repayment options. And oh, by the way, we're still grandfathering in people so that they can finish their programs with Plus loans with unlimited borrowing. But you're, you know, not having the same access to affordable repayment plans that reflects the level of debt that people have. Also, there's some very intense restrictions coming out of Department of Ed right now that say, even if you're grandfathered in, if you, for some reason, have a leave of absence, a medical leave of absence, a break in your schooling or something, then you lose access to those Plus loans and then you're subject to lifetime borrowing limits. Well, those lifetime borrowing limits are $257,500, and that's going to block people from accessing any federal student loans. What if a private lender won't underwrite somebody? Well, then you have hundreds of thousands of student loans and no degree and no way to pay back what you borrowed except for, you know, income-driven repayment and just praying that works out long-term, right? You know, and that you don't get just throw your hands up and say, what's the point? I mean, like, you know, so I think that what I'm concerned about is there will absolutely be a big increase in mental health challenges due to student loans. That's one of the things that keeps me going, keeps me wanting to make this podcast, because I do appreciate being able to help people. It's a wonderful thing to have a calling and be able to make a difference. And so I hope I can make a small difference in trying to alleviate some of that mental health burden. There are always options in life. What I like to tell people is, I've never met a financial problem that somebody's going through that is not reversible. That's so wonderful because my wife's a physician and there are absolutely a lot of medical problems that are irreversible, right? Somebody's got stage 4 cancer and there's no cure for it. You're going to die. And the only question is when. Now, of course, we're all going to die. But what I like to think of is like even the worst financial situation, if you analyze it, look at all the loopholes, look at all the rights, look at all the consumer protections, legal situation, pros, cons, ability to make changes. From all that I've learned over years and years of doing this, I'm just very confident that nobody is too far gone for help. You know, the financial stuff might feel like the weight of the world is upon you, but remember that it is nowhere near as serious as a health problem or something, or losing a loved one or something like that. Those are way more serious. And like even the worst financial problem is you're able to deal with it. Now, you might not be able to not have consequences. I'm going to be honest with that, right? Like there are people out there that may not be able to afford to stay in the same home that they're used to living in. And that's, I mean, or may not be able to afford to be a homeowner at all. And that's a serious consequence, right? They might have to buy a cheaper car, a beater car that's not as safe and reliable and go through stress of having to make that so that can create stress. I'm not saying that's not real stress or real consequences, but just there are always solutions and they might not be fun solutions or pleasant solutions, but there's always solutions versus, again, something like health where, you know, hey, you can go through all of this treatment, all of this chemo, and then you're still going to have eventually a bad outcome. I just want to encourage people to be a lot more hopeful about finances. And the other thing to say too is this is a pendulum situation. This is a pendulum political situation where the pendulum has, you know, during the Biden administration, it swung very hard in the let's cancel student debt situation. And then it swung very hard in this administration in the pay back your loans. The truth is the pendulum is not going to stay stuck. It's going to swing at some point again. I wouldn't recommend that somebody build their financial life around knowing that it eventually will swing. Right? You don't want to plan that your finances on hoping that, because that'll create stress. But, you know, for people who maybe have no other option, that's another encouragement I'd give you, is it's the rules for student loans are not going to stay like this forever. They will not. It's impossible. I don't know what they'll be, but they won't be this forever. So with that in mind, just be encouraged, encourage other borrowers, encourage other people you went to school with. And I want to take another question.
Hey, Travis, how's it going? Thanks for all that you do. I'm currently a resident with 2 years left in training, and after that, I'll be a fellow, but I'll be making significantly more as a fellow and then later as an attending. I'm currently on the safe forbearance, and I plan this summer, when forced, to go on to a different repayment plan. I know in the long term, since I'm going for PSLF, that I'm likely better off doing IBR when I have my fellow or attending income. My question is, would I be able to get onto RAP now, since as a resident, my payments would be lower, and then later on switch to IBR and have my time in RAP count towards my PSLF? Or would I be better off?
So first of all, you have to be able to even access the RAP plan, and that's not available until July. When you can access RAP, go ahead and get on it. And you know, if you're going for PSLF, for most residents, that's going to be the best option because it's like the best of both worlds. You know, you get subsidized interest for a lot of your loans. You also get PSLF credit. So, you know, it's kind of enabling you to take either a career path that you might want to take, either the private practice path or the public sector nonprofit hospital path. That's what I would encourage most people to do that are stuck on the save plan forbearance, that are going for PSLF, that are physicians right now, is just sort of try to hold out for the RAP plan, which hopefully will be available in July. Let's take one final question.
Hi, Travis. My name is Zach. I'm a resident in the Southeast. My question is regarding how to accurately calculate a debt-to-income ratio. We commonly hear that it may be advantageous to go for PSLF if you have a debt-to-income ratio of greater than 1 or 1.5, depending on who you ask. My question is regarding how do you calculate the income for a resident, given that their income will drastically increase as an attending? For example, if I were only to account for my attending income, my debt-to-income ratio would be approximately 0.4. However, if I were to calculate it based on my residency income, it would be close to 4. Let's say I'm in residency for 5 years. Would I then average the two, or how would I go about this calculation? Thank you.
I love technical questions like this. I think that the main thing you have to think through is there a way to get payments that are less than your loans collectively for your entire PSLF journey? And does that path make sense with what you want to do with your career? So what I mean by that is the wrap plan has no cap on payments. The IBR plan does have a cap on payments. The wrap plan has subsidized interest, basically. So you have a subsidy where it's equivalent to all the unpaid interest that your required payment doesn't pay, the government subsidizes that. So if you're going to go into private practice one day, or you might go into private practice one day, that's a wonderful benefit. You're getting an effective interest rate that's in the 1% to 2% range while you're in residency in that case, for most people. You're getting PSLF credit, but the problem is that when you become an attending, you know, you might have a payment, especially if you have a modest debt balance, that's really high. Now with IBR is better for a pure PSLF case, especially if it's new IBR, because you're able to get a payment that is really low and you have a capped payment that you can access regardless of income level. So for example, if your payment as resident is $300 a month with IBR, if your total debt is maybe $150,000, but maybe you make $300,000 as an attending, it doesn't matter that you're making way more than your debt. Your payment is capped with IBR if just about $1,500 a month, which is the standard plan. And if you do that math, the resident payments and the attending payments sum up to much less than your actual debt amount. So for PSLF physicians, actually PSLF makes sense, generally speaking, no matter what your debt-to-income ratio is. If you had $50,000 of debt, maybe not $50,000, because that's, but actually $50,000, if I ran the math on $50,000 for PSLF, fully optimized for a physician with a four-year residency and a $350,000 attending income, I bet I can make PSLF valuable for that person. Now, the problem is how valuable is it? That's the real question, because there's folks out there that have $500,000 of loans, and if you run the math, and then maybe they have a residency plus a fellowship, so they only need to be an attending for 3 or 4 years at a nonprofit to get PSLF. And if you run the math for those people, the pre-tax salary equivalent bonus benefit of PSLF is like $200,000 a year, maybe. Whereas if I run that math for, you know, somebody with a shorter length of training who has a much smaller amount of debt, the per year benefit might be $30,000 a year. Well, can you go out and make $30,000 more per year in private practice compared to a nonprofit 501c3? Probably, easily, right? So it all depends on the unique physician. It depends on the debt amount. It depends on the payment plans that are available, depending on when somebody borrowed. I think without sounding too self-serving, I think that's why people still pay us for a consult. I don't think it's because they like sending us checks because I'm such a great person. I think it's because we do offer more value from the consults than they cost. I think otherwise our reviews maybe wouldn't be as good. So that's just a biased opinion. But I think that in terms of calculating your debt-to-income ratio, I think that premise is wrong. I think PSLF always makes sense, no matter what your debt-to-income ratio, if you're a physician with any length of training, if you fully optimize it. And the reason it doesn't make sense to do is not because the debt-to-income ratio, it doesn't make sense because, you know, the benefits of doing private practice are just way more remunerative relative to the value of PSLF, and it fits with your long-term career plans. So that's hopefully kind of an interesting way to think about things. So a little bit of encouragement here. We're going to be working at Student Loan Planner on how to support future and current borrowers in addition to folks that have already done borrowing. I don't know what it means, to be honest, yet. Like, I don't know if this is going to be the once and future student loan borrower show, or the past, present, and future borrower show, or just the Student Loan Planner podcast where Travis riffs about whatever he feels like. Probably that one. But I think that I want to dive more deeply into helping people navigate what is truly going to be an absolute disaster this fall with federal funding for student loans. I mean, it's going to be a mess. And what I mean by that is, so many programs have annual borrowing limits now that are set at $20,500 per year. Living expenses for a grown person cost like $25,000 at least a year in most places. So your federal student loans are not even covering living expenses anymore, much less anything left over for, like, oh, hey, you know, tuition. So that's for any program not classified as a professional program. That's actually an alarmingly large number of programs that are not classified as professional programs. The professional programs are some of what you would expect, like, you know, medical, dental, vet, law, but then it's a couple random ones that you would not expect, like theology is a $50,000 per year borrowing limit, interestingly enough. I read a lot of the regulations talking about this, and they're like, there's a three-part test, and these are the three parts, and blah, 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 blah. And then there's like a logical inconsistency that comes where it's like, well, wait a second, you don't have to have a theology degree to practice as a minister. So like, why is that a professional degree? And they're like, oh, because we said so, you know? Then somebody points out like, well, wait a second, why is chiropractic considered a professional degree and nurse practitioners are not? And then they're like, you know, because blah, 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 blah. And then you point out another logical inconsistency and it's like, well, the statute says this, so we can't go beyond what the statute says. And of course, Congress, you know, so it's essentially, I mean, I don't know. I think it's kind of what most Department of Eds do, which is like, they're going to get to the answer that they want to get to. This is the powers that be and what they have decided. And, you know, this is the current powers that be, and the powers that be in the future will be different. So at least for the rest of the Trump administration, we're going to be dealing with ultra low borrowing limits. And it's really only coming into play for people who are first year students this coming fall. But every year, more and more people are going to be impacted by this. Let's say a physical therapy program is maybe, let's say it's a 3-year program. Well, the rising first year physical therapy students are going to be subject to these $20,500 per year limits, but the second and third year classes are going to be borrowing the full freight on Grad Plus and are grandfathered in. And so the 2/3 of the cash cow is still there, subsidizing the rest of the university. So I actually had an interesting talk about some of these kind of second and third order effects with one of our financial planners that used to be physical therapist. He's a financial planner for SLP Wealth now. And he was pointing out that, well, actually, the physical therapy program might actually be sustainable at a much lower cost. But what's going on is the universities are using these programs as their cash cows to subsidize the rest of the university and bring in revenues, basically. Like, they view it as a profit center, which I think that's true. And so then what the question is, well, will the physical therapy programs, the nurse practitioner programs, will they close down? Or will the other parts of the university that are super unprofitable close down because you can no longer use these other programs to subsidize them and use them as a profit center? I don't know, but it's going to be chaos. And so we'll be talking about a lot of the shocking things that are going to happen this fall in the coming weeks and months, because I do think even if you're already a practitioner, I think it's still pretty interesting and relevant to know what the future of your profession is going to look like and the way it's shaped with these really, really, really low loan limits. So we'll be talking about that in coming episodes. If you like the questions that people ask today, you can ask your own question. You can go to studentloanplanner.com/voicemail and ask your own question on our voicemail line for a show, a future episode of the show. I really appreciate how you listen to this podcast, even though it's about something super dry and boring like student loans. I'll try to liven it up every now and then. And if you need a consult over the next several weeks, you can go to studentloanplanner.com/book. If you want to go and get the most help, though, and get the full level of help that we can provide, also check out slpwealth.com. Thank you all for listening to the Student Loan Planner podcast, and have a great rest of your week. Are you on the free Student Loan Planner email list? If yes, you could upgrade your experience and discover student loan loopholes so good, they might get repealed if I talk about them publicly. Find out my very best thought leadership that I really just can't be super open about anymore, unfortunately. If you want to get our very best tips, not just the ones that I can share for free, go to studentloanplanner.com/insider to get a special discount for your year membership. That's studentloanplanner.com/insider and get our very best dozens of bonus content and tips that's going to save you money and get you out of student debt faster. And if you're already an SLP insider, please reply back to those emails and let me know how I can make it even more valuable.